Hi, I'm Warman Alney. Welcome again to our podcast listeners and our former radio listeners, now converted to the new podcast version of To the Point. Is this country finally turning a corner when it comes to sexual harassment? Hardly a new topic, but for more than a month, it's been in the headlines almost every day in Hollywood, in business, and of course, in politics. We had barely finished this podcast when CBS and public broadcasting anchor Charlie Rose was shown the door. We have a great cast, five panelists, and we'll get different opinions about how much our society is really changing. They'll be able to ask each other questions as we go along. The latest focus on sexual harassment began, of course, with the Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Here is the Norwegian actress Natasha Malti.
He was a very large man, and at the time I weighed 98 pounds. He began speaking about various A-list actors who he claimed had slept with him. He told me that these actresses had gotten to where they were because of him and because they had sex with him. He told me that every female Oscar winner had to thank him when they received their Oscars because he had made that possible. I believe I disassociated during that time that he was having sex with me. I laid still and closed my eyes and just wanted it to end. I played dead.
So Harvey Weinstein has lost his job, lost his company, lost all traces of the clout he used to wield. The flood of accusations has other men losing jobs and careers and possibly losing elected office. Will there be a backlash based on the need for standards of evidence? Will what seems like a movement begin to fade away? Liz Winstead is trying to make sure that doesn't happen. She was a co-creator of The Daily Show, co-founder of the progressive radio broadcast Air America, and founder of Lady Parts Justice. She is now encouraging women to use the hashtag MeAt14. Liz Winstead, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's MeAt14? What do you hope to accomplish?
I think, when we heard the accusations of Roy Moore assaulting a girl at 14, and when he said on Sean Hannity that he would date women who were younger with their mother's permission, it really just made me sick inside to think that this person who was wielding their power to abuse women was calling it dating so that it would put the onus on these young women. And so I wanted people to remember what 14-year-olds look like. I wanted people to actually also be 14 and to be able to say, this is who I am at 14, and tell their story about 14, about their innocence, about the people that had abused them, and create a conversation amongst each other, because women far too long have been so tired of making and explaining and hoping people understand that harassment and abuse is rampant and that it comes in very different forms and that people have gone through it differently, and we want people to know that it exists.
All right. You mentioned the case of Roy Moore. Let us hear first from Beverly Young Nelson, who describes an incident from her youth. She says that the now candidate for this U.S. Senate in Alabama, Roy Moore, who was then a district attorney, assaulted her. They were in a car together. She rebuffed him, and here's her account of their exchange.
At some point, he gave up. And he then looked at me and he told me, he said, you're just a child. And he said, I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you.
And here is Roy Moore on Sean Hannity's radio program about having girlfriends who were teenagers when he was a grown man. And here's what he had to say about it.
I don't remember that, and I don't remember ever dating any girl without the permission of her mother. And I think in her statement, she said that her mother actually encouraged her to go out with me.
So, Liz Winstead, back to you. How does his explanation sound to you, given the kind of accusation we heard from Beverly Young Nelson?
I don't even know what that means. He has danced around it so much. And for me, all it sounds like is, oh, I can't remember ever doing that, but if I did remember doing it, I asked their mother for permission, so I put the ownership of this person's body, of this 14-year-old's body, onto the parent of the body, and it's like, what about the girl? Why should a mother be able to get permission for a grown man to date her? Like, it's it floors me.
Let me move along, and we'll get back to Liz Winstead as the program develops. But I want to introduce Christine Bader. She's the author of The Evolution of a Corporate Idealist When Girl Meets Oil. She was an executive at BP, then at Amazon, until she quit to concentrate on raising her children. She's now a contributing writer for The Atlantic and author of Is There Any Way to Be an Ethical Moviegoer in the Post-Weinstein Era? We've heard a little about politics. Christine Bader, what do you mean by that title?
Thanks, Warren. I'm still sorry. I think that the previous segment and Liz, your powerful points here, they're so stunning and just so offensive that it's hard for me to move into a mode of talking about commercialism. But I think it is important because I've spent most of my career in the circles of corporate responsibility and sustainability. And what's happened over the past few weeks has made me think about the links to other industries and what has happened and the power of the consumer. So I think that by buying our movie tickets and by loving these movies, we have, in effect, unwittingly propped up Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, all these other men who have been accused of these horrible crimes. And there's been an interesting thread of the conversation, which has been wondering, well, what's gone into the making of these films that we've watched, just as over the past 20 years, people have started to wonder, what's gone into the making of the shirt on my back or the shoes on my feet? So I wrote this piece in The Atlantic wondering this question out loud, saying, is there any way for me to apply these principles of trying to be an ethical consumer? Is there any way of my doing that in the entertainment industry today?
So what do you do then? For example, Woody Allen was accused of similar kinds of things. He ultimately ended up marrying his daughter-in-law, or excuse me, stepdaughter, I beg your pardon, and yet people flock to his movies.
It's so true, and I don't honestly know what the answer is, which is part of why I wanted to pose the question in this piece. I mean, what is really clear is that what's happened in the past couple weeks is amazing, because getting bad guys, I am all for it. And I think that there hopefully is a sea change underway in that individuals who have perpetrated these violations are being held to account. And I think that is awesome. But what is also clear is that this problem is so embedded and so entrenched that we need to do more than just lopping off the head or other appropriate body parts and thinking about what's going to bring about cultural and systemic and institutional change with the way that this industry is run.
So you're talking just about the movie industry at the moment. You mentioned people making shoes and shirts and what might happen there. Certainly there could be a lot of sexual harassment in that area. Will we ever be able to deal with that?
Oh, sure. And so what I think has happened over the past 20 years is by no means have we eradicated human rights abuses in these other industries, but these moments of outrage have actually resulted in a number of companies and human rights groups and worker advocates coming together, setting standards, and creating institutions and systems that help prevent these abuses. Again, abuses aren't gone, but we actually have made a lot of progress in the past 20 years of a number of industries coming together and setting new standards and trying to figure out how to eradicate and prevent bad behavior and reward good behavior. And I think it's time for the entertainment industry to have its turn.
Okay, we've talked about Roy Moore, a Republican candidate for the Senate, of course, in Alabama. Minnesota Democrat Senator Al Franken has now admitted to unwanted kissing on a USO tour in 2006, and he smiled while his picture was taken, fondling the breasts of a sleeping woman. Here's his accuser, Leanne Tweeden, a radio news anchor in Los Angeles.
And he's like, Leanne, you know, actors, we have to rehearse everything. You have to rehearse the kiss. And just to make it go away and to make him stop, I'm like, okay, well, rehearse the damn kiss, you know? And it happened so fast that as I'm like, okay, we're going to rehearse the kiss, you know, and as we're coming in, he comes up and he grabs me and he puts his hand behind my head and he aggressively comes in and he mashes his mouth up against mine and he sticks his tongue in my mouth.
Liz Winstead, back to you. Once again, you were a co-founder of Air America Radio, so was Al Franken. Interested in your take on this?
If you're doing something against somebody's will and they've said no, you have to say no. It's appalling.
Apparently, Al Franken has asked for an ethics investigation, but I want to introduce Norm Ornstein, congressional scholar, American Enterprise Institute, co-author of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Norm Ornstein, always good to hear from you.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Is this going to make it very difficult for politicians who are named in the way that Al Franken has been, even though he asks for an ethics investigation, to go forward? Some people have talked about him as a potential presidential candidate.
It clearly is going to make it more difficult for him to engage in the issues of which he's engaged, and that will be true for others as well. There is at least one distinction. I noticed that Matthew Dowd, one of George W. Bush's key aides, has mentioned, which is that Franken, you know, immediately admitted that he had done this and apologized. And Roy Moore, a Donald Trump, say deny it and blame the women. At some point, we're going to figure out a way to sort out crude and bad and inexcusable behavior from the truly predatory and awful behavior, and then figure out what the appropriate punishment is for all of this. I don't think we're quite there yet. But my guess is that, in fact, I am sure this is not the last shoe to drop, that we're going to see a lot of men who did inappropriate things, who pushed themselves on women who said no, who did behave in crude ways. Some of them, there will be a long pattern of predatory behavior. Others, it may be one or two or three incidents. But a lot of stuff that was either taken for granted or pushed under the rug or had women for reasons of power disparities, and so much of this is about power and not about sex, have not spoken up or not spoken up because they saw what can happen when you do, as we've seen with some of the threats against the women in Alabama and in other places. This is going to be a long time, I think, sorting itself out. And in a very positive way, we're seeing behavior that was either accepted or condoned or ignored for a long time finally brought to account. What I'm waiting for, Warren, along with this, is this great division that we have. You know, we're now seeing, obviously, stuff that's hit huge numbers of women over the years, starting out their careers or in places where it was almost impossible for them to speak out when the costs would be too great, taking humiliation or much worse. One of the things that I'm waiting for is a much broader acknowledgement, and I don't know when it will come, of the trauma that African Americans have felt when they send their kids out into cars or just out for an evening, not knowing what might happen to them. There's behavior that we have either ignored or dismissed or rationalized in the past that shouldn't be. Harvey Weinstein broke this open for women with male predators, mostly male predators. And I'm hoping we'll see it in other social settings where other people have been preyed upon.
Again, Norm Ornstein is with the American Enterprise Institute. Kathy Young is with us, contributing editor for Reason, columnist for Newsday, regular contributing writer for The Forward. Her most recent article is titled Confusing Sexual Harassment with Flirting Hurts Women. Kathy Young, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've indicated that you think maybe we're going too far too fast and that people are being accused, as we've heard, and conclusions are being drawn about them. They may be suffering unnecessarily. How concerned are you about that?
Sort of come back for a moment to what you were just discussing, which is the Al Franken incident. I mean, I have looked at what has been published about it so far, and you know what Al Franken has admitted is essentially he says that he doesn't remember this incident the same way that his accuser does. So you know, we're not really quite sure what happened there. I mean, people may, and this is not necessarily to say that you know one of them is lying. People may remember the same thing in different ways. You know, we actually know from psychological research that people's memories are very often sort of processed through their subsequent view of things. The photograph that is being talked about right now as supposedly showing him groping her, I actually think, and I've heard a number of people say the same thing, that it's sort of a mock grope where he's kind of mugging for the camera and he's pretending to, you know, his hands are kind of hovering over her breasts, which, by the way, she was wearing a flak jacket because this was a USO tour. So it really doesn't appear that there was any physical contact. Now, was this a really crass and tacky joke? Yeah, sure. I mean, I absolutely agree, unless she agreed to it, which it appears that she didn't because she was asleep at the time. But, I mean, this is the kind of thing where I'm wondering if we're going too far in kind of, you know, applying the death penalty to everything, basically. Because, you know, if you look at Harvey Weinstein, if you look at Mark Halperin, who's a journalist who had to resign when there were numerous claims of essentially sexual assault, where he had, you know, physically assaulted women, basically. When you take that and you compare that to the allegations against Al Franken so far, you know, unless we have other accusers coming forward, which so far hasn't happened, it just seems to me that there is a real danger in conflating this extremely serious behavior, which in Harvey Weinstein's case is multiple allegations of rape, and allegations, one of which is actually corroborated by an audio where he admits, you know, groping a woman, groping a model who he was having a business meeting with. When you take that and you compare it to some of these other incidents, there really is no comparison. You know, when you take Roy Moore, we're talking about alleged assaults on a 14-year-old child, which is completely unconscionable, and it appears that there's a lot of corroboration for this. So I'm just concerned about lumping together incidents of really incomparable magnitude, and you know, which is not to say that we should say that it's okay to, you know, be crass and offensive as long as you're not raping people. Of course, it's not. But I am concerned about this kind of loss of perspective.
Okay. Well, let me interrupt you for a moment and go back to Liz Winstead. We hear Kathy Young saying that maybe the charges against Al Franken aren't all that bad. You said it was pretty disgusting behavior. What's your take on the problem of going too far too fast?
I mean, I feel like I don't want to compare anybody's harassment or abuse to anyone else's. I think that does a disservice to each individual who's been in an experience, gets to have that experience and shouldn't have it diminished because it wasn't a Roy Moore situation. I think that there's something incredibly demeaning about taking a photograph where you're simulating putting your hands on someone's breasts and they're sleeping and it's against their will. I mean, that's not cool. You don't know that person's life story.
Well, does it disqualify Al Franken from being a candidate for president? A lot of people have said that perhaps he will be.
How Al talks about it, how Al deals with it, how people hear him, what he's learned from the experience of people coming forward, all of that's to be revealed by a lot of it. I think the bigger narrative is people of color, people of different genders, and women have not had agency forever, and they are not holding power. And so people who do not fundamentally understand what happens and what that feels like to constantly have to swallow things that make you feel like a buzzkill, that make you feel like somebody who maybe wouldn't like that to happen if you've said no in a plethora of situations, you know, how does that help you or hurt you further your career? Unless we really start having conversations that are real, and that when women talk about the pain of what these situations feel like and it's absolutely heard and people take it into account, we're going to keep on this rabbit wheel of judging how somebody felt about something that happened to them and constantly comparing it to something else. I mean, I don't think that just doesn't sound good to me at all.
All right. I'm Warren Olney. Once again, this is the podcast of To the Point, and we're going to take a very brief break. We'll be right back. Warren Olney back with To The Point, the podcast version, talking with Liz Winstead, Christine Bader, Kathy Young, Norm Ornstein, and one more guest, Deborah Rohde. She's professor of law, former director of the Center of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender at Stanford University. Her most recent book is Women and Leadership. Great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've heard a moment ago just from Liz Winstead and from our other guests as well that there's no way at the moment that women can have agency, as Liz Winstead put it, be able to bring forward their complaints and their concern about, obviously, retaliation and all the rest. What can you tell us as an attorney, as a former student, or as a student of women and gender at Stanford University? What are the rules? What do we have now, and what do we need?
Well, we know historically women have been harassed for centuries, but not until relatively recently did they even have a term for it, let alone a remedy or a complaint channel. Now, after some five decades of law on this subject, we still have patterns of persistent and pervasive sexual harassment in the workplace. And part of the reason for the lack of adequate legal recourse is that very few women who experience incidents have felt able to complain, less than somewhere on the order of 5 to 15% of people tell anyone, and only about and less than 5% end up in court. And part of the reason is that traditionally we have victimized the victim, and women who've come forward have been silenced, berated, blacklisted, humiliated, sometimes stalked and threatened. And we've seen this in recent revelations about Harvey Weinstein and Bill O'Reilly and how they silenced, either through money or intimidation, women who made complaints. And what I think is hopeful about the sort of recent cascade of complaints is that women now feel much more empowered to come forward, not only through legal channels, but also through social media and going to the press. And when you have someone like Susan Fowler who can just post a blog on Uber that goes viral and forces the company to do a major investigation, fire more than a dozen leaders of the company and the CEO to step down, I think that speaks to the power that women are beginning to feel. And, you know, all it takes is for the first penguin off the iceberg for more women oftentimes to come forward. So, you know, Roger Ailes tried to intimidate Gretchen Carlson, but when more women came forward to say, me too, that's what ultimately led to his ouster. And the cascade of complaints that we're seeing in cases like Weinstein or Moore or O'Reilly or Ailes really, I think, make clear that this is a moment when we can try to deal with serial abuse.
Now
these
we have
folks who felt they can be that they're entitled, that they're insulated, and that's no longer the case.
Okay, for maybe that's true, maybe that's not. Let me remind our listeners and our guests as well of what happened last year when President Trump, now President Trump, was subject to the release of this tape.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy. I can do anything.
So, Norm Ornstein, why wasn't that enough to cause Donald Trump not to be elected?
Well, you know, it was interesting to watch the dynamic of this. It was a huge story for several days, and then James Comey intervened with his letter and took it off the radar screen of large numbers of Americans.
Former FBI agent came out saying that something about Hillary Clinton.
Right, and that first Comey letter completely changed the news cycle and the news coverage. But what I found so interesting about that was the first reaction of many Republican prominent office holders was shock and disapproval. Jason Chaffetz, major committee chair from Utah, said, "I withdraw my endorsement and support. How could I look my 14-year-old daughter in the eye after this?" Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, did a conference call with all of his members, said he was appalled and he was withdrawing his support. Mitch McConnell slammed Trump. And then a week later, apparently Chaffetz decided either he didn't have to look his 14-year-old daughter in the eye or he could do it in another way, and said, "I'm going to vote for him." The same with Ryan, the same with McConnell. Political expediency trumped it, and we've seen this in many other cases, and obviously we've seen it now with a large number of people refusing to condemn Roy Moore. You know, the idea that it's one of yours and that tribal instinct, along with the, my goodness, if he gets elected, look at all of the tax cuts we can impose, became a part of it. Now, you know, I think there's a couple of interesting dynamics to watch here, Warren. One is whether Trump comes back into the picture because we have 17 women who have openly accused him of misbehavior. And, you know, the standard that we've at least begun to use with Roy Moore, and I think we're using it more broadly now, that a woman who speaks up, we take seriously. But when you've got multiple women and more coming forward, despite the pressure and the obloquy that they get for it, you take it even more seriously. And we're also seeing a reexamination of Bill Clinton in that light. We're going to see a number of people who are going to be held to account by a standard that wasn't applied 20 years ago, 10 years ago, or even in 2016. Having said that, I do think that the point of making sure that not everybody, no matter the level of the offense, the crudity of all of them, the awful character notwithstanding, you can't treat everybody the same. And you know, and I do think that the idea that all of these require the toughest action, expulsion from the Senate or force with the resignations or whatever it might be, we have to in some way try to look to calibrate. We have to take seriously things that were never taken seriously before. We have to recognize that this is unacceptable behavior. But, you know, just to pick another example.
Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt you because we don't want to have male dominance on this program. So far we have. I've been asking all of the questions, and everybody has been dutifully responding. I said at the beginning that I would allow everybody to ask each other questions. And let me now provide that opportunity to all of our guests. If you want to ask a question, please say who you are and who you want to ask the question of. Go ahead.
I have one for Norm.
Who's this?
This is Deborah Rohde.
Okay.
Yes.
I've been asked by a number of reporters whether I think the allegations against Donald Trump would get more traction if they happened now in the current atmosphere. And I think it's just really hard to know how much of people's willingness to give him a pass had to do with their willingness to give him a pass on everything else. You know, all the allegations of cheating and dishonesty and stiffing contractors and, cheating students at Trump University and so forth. I mean, a third of Americans thought he lacked honesty. Only a third of Americans thought he had honesty and integrity, and 63 million voted for him anyway. So I don't know. I'd like to think that we've had a collective consciousness raising and a real wake-up call that's going to change the dialogue, and some of the suits against Trump are going to eventually go forward. But I don't know how much of it was politics and how much of it was just a traditional attitude toward, you know, women make this up, it's locker room banter, that's not who he really is, quote unquote.
Norm Ornstein, what about that?
Oh, I think it's a really important set of questions. One part of it is, and this is what dismays me as much as anything about Trump, we have a sentence in the book that Donald Trump is the first political figure who's managed to fend off one scandal with another. And scandal after scandal, you become deadened. And what happens is that, as the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, we define deviancy down. And so much of the behavior, the kleptocratic behavior, the lying, becomes commonplace. I think that might have been the case with this kind of sexual abuse if it weren't for Weinstein. I think that has opened up a completely different venue here. And we are going to treat perpetrators in a different way. But is that going to lead to action against Donald Trump? I'm very, very skeptical of that because none of the other stuff. We haven't had a single hearing on the kleptocracy using the presidency for personal gain in the House or the Senate. They're going to stay away from Donald Trump as much as they possibly can, and I think they're going to use the allegations against Roy Moore and against Franken as a way of trying to do that. And it's only if we see these powerful figures brought to account that we'll see the dramatic change that we need. But I do think what Weinstein has done is to change the way we look at all these other figures, and I suspect we're going to see it in so many other walks of life where men in positions of power have behaved horribly towards those who don't have the power.
I'm going to interject myself again, even though I promised to let people interrupt, and I won't go a call on anybody necessarily specifically after this, but let's remember Anita Hill, 1991, testifying to sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas, who was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice and, of course, ultimately confirmed despite her testimony to this effect.
On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. Because I was extremely uncomfortable talking about sex with him at all, and particularly in such a graphic way, I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects.
So what about the treatment of Anita Hill in the media? Who wants to talk about that?
Warren, this is Christine. I think that Anita Hill's story underscores what I think everybody has rightly made, the point that everybody's rightly made in this discussion, which is that the work that we all need to do now is articulate or re-articulate what the norm is, and that we all need to do this really important work of defining what is acceptable and what is unacceptable behavior. And Norm brought it up, and Kathy brought it up, and Deborah and Liz, too, I think by your rightful outrage. I think that we all need to do this work of coming together and really spelling out what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior so that people that do cross the line, that we all agree where the line is, can be held to account. And again, other industries have gone through this, right? So 30 years ago, we had to have this conversation about, well, what is a sweatshop? And when you say that, of course, people have pictures in their mind, but they're different. And there is all this, well, that's just the way people do things over there. And I have a lot of those same echoes today. So I think that now the work that we need to do is define what the standard is and what the norms are. And as Kathy said, and Kathy in your terrific LA Times op-ed, I think defining the difference between low-level lechery and this truly predatory behavior.
So Kathy Young, what about
thanks
it?
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
I was actually wondering if I could jump in here because, you know, I remember that conversation that we had at the time of Anita Hill's testimony. And I think one thing that happened, it was in some ways, minus the social media, it was actually quite similar to what's been going on now. There were a lot of women coming forward with their own experiences. And I think part of what kind of undercut that momentum is that we did start seeing a kind of overreach where there were reports of these incredibly trivial cases where people were losing their jobs over things like, discussing at the office a joke that had been on Seinfeld the night before that was a little racy, or, bringing to work a copy of Esquire to read over lunch where somebody was offended by the fact that it had racy lingerie ads. And it was things like that. that that I think led a lot of people to think that, well, this is just a lot of trivial stuff, and, you know, this is just people being incredibly hypersensitive. And I think there were also people who felt, you know, including myself, that there was a kind of almost neo-Victorian attitude toward women in a lot of this, where there was a kind of presumption that women are inherently offended by sexual jokes, and a lot of people were saying that, you know, women themselves very often tell sexual jokes in the workplace. I remember that there were a number of legal cases in which actually one of the issues was that, you know, the same women who were complaining about sort of sexualized behavior by men had themselves apparently engaged in equally sexualized behavior. And this is when, of course, you start getting into questions like, you know, are there power differentials that are based on rank at the company, or is gender itself a kind of source of power differential? And I think there is a legitimate question of, you know, are we kind of denying women's agency if we're saying that women inherently have less power in the situation regardless of their status at the company. So I think a lot of these are very, very complicated questions. There's the question of, you know, is it ever appropriate to have workplace relationships? A lot of people have workplace relationships, you know, including sometimes with people of a higher rank. And I can think of a number of examples. You know, Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, for instance, I was just rereading the other day, where he met his wife when they were both government employees. And she initially was sort of, she was at the time, she was, she identified as a lesbian, and she was not interested in dating him, and eventually, apparently, he sort of courted her quite aggressively. And this is the kind of thing where even some of the reports on this said, you know, this is the kind of thing that in a different context could be seen as a sexual harassment story, except in this case, okay, they actually ended up being in a relationship and they're married. So there's a lot of nuance that I think we risk losing if we kind of lump everything into the same category. And I think that is something we need to be careful about, because I think the backlash that may happen due to overreactions will actually undercut the very legitimate and very much needed effort to curb these horrible abuses that we have been hearing about.
Deborah Rohde, what do you think of that?
Well, what do I think of what exactly?
Well, this idea that there are differences, that there are nuances, that we, as we establish new standards, which you and Norm Ornstein, I think, and others have, as well, have called for, do we have to be careful not to throw innocent people out, as it were?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, any time that you enable this kind of airing of grievances that are decades old, often, you worry that the pendulum could swing and that people will be unable to establish their innocence after this much passage of time. And especially now with social media, the ability of people to come forward without any gatekeepers along the lines that the press has traditionally supplied raises possibilities of extortion and damaging reputations, and so forth. And I think Kathy's absolutely right that there's a danger of lumping various kinds of behavior together under the general heading of predatory, when in fact it has quite different consequences and importance both for society and the victims. But having said that, I do think it's really healthy for the culture to reexamine the way it's devalued and silenced complainants. And maybe we're going to have to suffer a bit of overreaction in order to get the balance right.
Liz Winstead,
well, also,
back to you. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I promised I wouldn't, but I'm going to anyway, because I want to ask Liz Winstead a question. Now, you were co-creator, former head writer of The Daily Show. That made a big difference in the way people get news. You also were co-founder of Air America Radio. It's not on anymore, but it was for a long time. So you've thought a lot about media and had a lot to do with media. We heard Norm Ornstein say earlier that one scandal was dealt with by the president simply by introducing another scandal. What do the media all have to do with this, and are there new rules that ought to apply there?
I think that I would really like to just sort of address what is the conversation that just happened before I get into that, because we talk constantly about the agency of this and people overreacting that. And the bottom line is, in workplace, in media, wherever we are, there is not a balance of power. We have not had a balance of power. And so unless we have a balance of power, women can come forward, but if the people they're still coming forward to are the people who have set the rules, who have decided that the abuse continues, we're not going to get anywhere. So the self-examination of what we're doing and what this abuse looks like and the varying ways in which it happens is all different, because the agency of the people in the space are also different. And until we start having a balance of power, where we can all tell that joke, whatever that joke is, and nobody, if somebody says, well, that's weird, like, that isn't cool, and be like, oh, you're right, sorry, and nobody feels offended by it, you know, until we get to that point, we're just going to keep running in circles and keep talking about it as the issue that, you know, the people who are victimized have to come forward. To who? The oppressor? I mean, we need to shake up how the system works and who's in power and who's making decisions.
Here's some very interesting testimony by two women, members of the Congress, at a recent House panel on sexual harassment. Democratic California Congresswoman Jackie Speier alludes to harassment by colleagues, and Republican Barbara Comstead of Virginia shares a story.
In fact, there are two members of Congress, Republican and Democrat, right now, who serve.
This member asked a staffer to bring them over some materials to their residence and was greeted with a member in a towel, who was a male, who then invited her in. At that point, he decided to expose himself.
Norm Ornstein, no names. Are there congressmen who are quaking in their shoes that they might be the ones that these women were talking about?
No doubt about that. And what's also important to remember is two things. One, we're seeing this in state legislatures now. Two prominent figures in the Minnesota legislature, a Democrat and a Republican, likely be forced out because of misbehavior. A real scandal, which is the way Congress has dealt with complaints of sexual harassment in both an opaque fashion and by covering up through settlements to keep any of this from becoming public. And I'm sure more of it will happen now. As I'm sure we're going to see it in other places where there are power relationships, too. Just a word on the media stuff. One of the things I just noticed a little while ago, I got an email. Mike Allen, who does a blog thing on news happening in Washington for Axios. And the big thing is about Al Franken, and it goes on and on and on. And then in a tiny thing, what you missed. The House passed its tax cut plan, and this is what I saw seen today on cable television as well. Scandal stories tend to overwhelm everything else, and without a whole lot of proportion involved, and there was almost nothing on a tax bill that gives enormous sums to corporations and wealthy individuals, takes away scholarship protection for graduate students, which is going to be a horrific blow to our future in science and technology, among other places, is a $25 billion cut per year in Medicare, and does all kinds of other things that would otherwise be a big story that now becomes a small story. And it is, I think, a reflection of our inability at this point to calibrate these things. And that's going to include calibrating the kinds of punishment that are there for gross and inappropriate and bad things like sticking your tongue down the mouth of somebody who doesn't want it, all the way down to serial child predation and rape. And until we can get to a point, it's good that we're doing this. As Liz said, there may be some collateral damage along the way. And that could be very bad collateral damage.
Okay.
We're finally outing this, but we're at a point now, I think, where we haven't quite figured out how to deal with it and what balance we need.
All right, I'm
going to go ahead.
Who's this?
It's Liz.
Okay.
And if I could even to Norm's point, this tax bill that Norm just listed off, amazingly horrible things that could happen to people. And one thing that's in that tax bill that Norm didn't list and that the media isn't listing is the fact that there's language in there that that reaffirms the personhood of a human being to be life beginning at conception, which is a purposeful unraveling of Roe v. Wade to redefine when human beings start life. And that, to me, is a reflection also. When we have Democrats saying, you know what, abortion can be on the table. You know, when we have these things of our supposed allies who aren't even focusing on autonomy and agency of human bodies, and especially the bodies of women, you know, that's also something to look at. When we talk about women, how do we prioritize women? Are we going to prioritize systematic harassment and abuse if we're not prioritizing them, period?
Well, that was Liz Winstead, first on our program, and it turns out she is last on our program as well. You guys have been terrific. Thank you so very much for being with us. Liz, Christine Bader, Kathy Young, Norm Ornstein, and Deborah Rohde. And thanks to our listeners as well.
Thanks to you.
Thank you, Warren.
Congrats on the podcast.
As I said at the outset, since we had this conversation, more idols have fallen, including the longtime news interviewer and anchor Charlie Rose, fired by CBS News for intolerable behavior, despite his apology for pursuing what he mistakenly thought were shared feelings. But different cases, like those of Roy Moore and Senator Al Franken, as we've heard, raise questions of false equivalency. As accusations pile up, it's clear we're only beginning to write new rules for the age-old problem of sexual harassment in the workplace. I'm Warren Olney. This To The Point podcast was produced by Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz. You can join us wherever you get your podcasts, including kcrw.com/To The Point.